Here are a few paragraphs from the sutra that describes the Buddha's death, called a parinirvana, final nirvana. So the Buddha is speaking. He's lying down between some trees. The monks are gathered and nuns are gathered, and lay people too, people from the far and wide, I guess. So the Buddha uses this time to teach his last. This isn't quite the end, you know, it's like, you know, there's several chapters, but towards the end, he uses this time to teach what he'd already been teaching for 45 years. He said, "O monks and nuns, I say to you that these teachings, of which I have direct knowledge, and which have been made known to you, these you should thoroughly learn, cultivate, develop, and frequently practice, that the life of purity may be established and may long endure. For the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, well-being, and happiness of gods and humans." And what, O monks and nuns, are these teachings? You know that you should do all this with. They are the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four constituents of power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the teachings of which I have direct knowledge, which I have made known to you, and which you should thoroughly learn, cultivate, develop, and frequently practice, so that the life of purity may be established and may long endure for the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, well-being, and happiness of gods and humans. Then the Blessed One said to the monks and nuns, "I exhort you, all compound things are subject to vanish. Strive with earnestness. The time of the Tathagata's parinirvana is near. Soon the Tathagata will pass utterly away." And having spoken these words, the Happy One, it's translated the Happy One, the Great Master, spoke again, saying in verse, "My years are now full ripe, the lifespan left is short. Departing, I go hence from you, relying on myself alone. Be earnest then, O monks and nuns, be mindful and of pure virtue. With firm resolve, guard your mind. Who so untiringly pursues the Dharma and the discipline shall go beyond the rounds of births and make an end of suffering." So a little excerpt of the Parinirvana Sutra, so heavy duty stuff. What's interesting is that he didn't have some new secret special teaching for the very end. He returned to things that he had been teaching and these monks and nuns had been studying and working with for many years. So there's this sense of keeping going, simple practice over and over and over again. So let me read you that list of like verbs so we kind of know what our charge is here according to this sutra. That you should learn, thoroughly learn, cultivate, develop, and frequently practice. So that's the action items on the agenda. Thoroughly learn, cultivate, develop, and frequently practice. So it's not like a one-time thing. Frequently practice. And then he gives a purpose to this. Like, why would you do all this? And the purpose is so that the life of purity may be established and long endure, and so that the welfare and happiness of the multitude out of compassion for the world, so it's going to help everybody, the whole world, for the benefit, well-being, and happiness of gods and humans. And so we give a bunch of lists, a list of lists. So this is this list of lists that I'm on about lately. So you're stuck with it for a while. So here's a handout. What you want to be looking at. I thought we'd get started tonight. We had a great long talk a couple weeks ago, like, and didn't get to the list, you know. Oh, you know, can I have one of those back? Sorry. I need the list too. So this handout that I gave you is 37 items long, arranged in seven lists. So in the second paragraph of the sutra, that's what he's referring to. Oh, I didn't quite make enough, huh? Sorry. I'll give you mine on the way out, so you can look on. And I've arranged them a little bit with a little introductory verse and a closing verse as a ceremony we can do, and we did do together once here, and I've been really enjoying doing the ceremony in my home practice, and I recommend it. Because one thing about these teachings from early Buddhism is that they can seem a little dry at first, right? These lists, like I'm just giving you this list, and now you're trying to like, there's a lot of repeated words, there's a lot of unfamiliar words. And so it's wonderful to find ways to bring these kinds of lists and teachings to life, so that we really sort of learn them and bring them into our bodies. So I've been chanting this and bowing with each of these 37 items in the morning at home. And so I thought I'd give you just a little more background on the whole list, and we'd start talking about the first set tonight, which we've talked about before, but I have some new ways of thinking about them that might be helpful. So in this sutra, the Buddha listed these seven lists, this list of seven, which later came to be called, in Mahayana Buddhism, the Bodhipakshika Dharma. So Bodhi means awakening. Pakshika means like things that relate to something, things that relate to something. And Dharma has a really wonderful double meaning. That's going to show up several times in the title, and it'll show up several times in the list too. So, and in English, the two meanings are usually distinguished in writing in English with a capital D and a lowercase d, but I don't think they have capitalization in Sanskrit, so I think that's an English convention. Must be, you know, some English guy in Sri Lanka invented that, Rhys Davids or somebody. So big D Dharma is the Buddha's teaching. The teachings of the Buddha. So in a way, the first meaning is things that relate to the Buddha's teaching on awakening. So that makes sense. But little d dharma means experience itself. And they had a whole complicated sort of system in early Buddhism of evaluating experience. They meditated so darn much that they started to distinguish, you know, very fine sort of a granularity to experience. And they created a whole kind of taxonomy of experiences that you can have. So these are dharmas. It's like an atom of experience, smallest unit of experience you can have. And so that's interesting that this word dharma means Buddha's teachings that lead to liberation, and at the same time mean experience itself. So what's implied there? Well, lots of things, and you should think about it yourself. But one possibility is it's suggesting that the Buddha's teachings are not something new that is put on top of experience, not some sort of external organizing principle or description or something like that, but rather a way of looking at experience itself that's more skillful or leads to more happiness or leads to like complete freedom from suffering, depending on how you look at it. And so this list has both of those elements. It's rooted in experience. These are not just things to sort of memorize and try to remember and put post-its on your fridge. Well, you could do that. but the things that are rooted in experience of our living itself. Ways of sort of reimagining and re-understanding and re-investigating experience itself. And what another thing I remembered was when I was in college, I was studying biology, mostly botany, which is the study of plants. And there's an awful lot of plants, you know, in North America. And other parts of the world are even more diverse. And I found it really baffling, you know. I couldn't remember the names of the plants until I took what they call systematics in botany, which is like learning an organizing principle. You learn plant families, and the plant families have characteristics, and their families are divided, you know, there's different divisions and orders and stuff. And it was the weirdest thing. It's like suddenly it all sort of like, you know, I didn't suddenly know every plant in North America, but suddenly like I had like something to hang my hat on. Suddenly it was much easier to understand, like significantly easier to understand, much, much easier to learn new plants, something to fit them into. And so last year when I ran into a book on this list of lists by Chan Master Sheng Yin, here's the book, I thought, wow, you know, there's a way of sort of organizing all these early Buddhist teachings taught to us by a Chinese Zen master. So there's a connection to our, very direct connection to our way of practice and to earlier Buddhism. And it also turns out this list of lists is studied extensively by Theravadin practitioners and scholars. And there's a great long, long book about this list by Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who was sitting right here this last weekend. Surprisingly enough. Maybe right there. John. Unfortunately, we weren't here. Was anybody there? None of us were there. Yeah, maybe next time. And he has a great long list with lots of excerpts from the Pali Canon. So I thought, this is a list that sort of transcends different Buddhisms, because there's really not just one. There are many Buddhisms. And can provide us with kind of a topology of applied practice. And as I went on and on about a couple weeks ago, and you can listen for the website if you want to, we can kind of hold this with a certain spirit, though. It'd be easier for us to turn this long list into like a huge to-do list, like a really huge to-do list, which we'll never quite do right and always be failing and falling down. So we're coming into this with a spirit from our Zen practice, a spirit of stability, a spirit of completeness in this moment. That we're both fine, you know, we're already fine. We just need to relax into being fine, you know, goodness gracious. And we could use a little improvement. And we could pay a heck of a lot more attention to our experience. So I thought it would be useful. So the first section of the Bodhipakshika Dharma is the four foundations of mindfulness. And mindfulness, this word is in the air a lot lately. It's being applied outside of Buddhism and is a construct that's used in many different branches of Buddhism. And the word mindfulness itself shows up again and again in the other lists. So the first list is about mindfulness, and then mindfulness is also in the other lists. And actually, just this morning, I was here teaching a secular form of mindfulness, and it really seems to help people a lot. There are 20 people in the room, most of whom had never meditated before, were studying mindfulness. It seemed to really be helpful to them. So four foundations of mindfulness. This comes straight from an early Buddhist text called the Mindfulness Sutra, the Satipatthana Sutta. And these different secular trainings and things are basically based on this sutra, as is this list. So the importance of this first list is really hard to underestimate. It's really huge. And sitting there with a couple of words and a piece of paper, it doesn't look like much, but it's quite a huge and important thing. And so the Pali word that's translated as mindfulness is sati. So Pali is the language they first wrote down Buddha's teachings in southern India and Sri Lanka. And there's an analogous word in Sanskrit, which is something like smriti. So this word that they're translating, so mindfulness is an English word, right? So you wonder, like, what did they really mean? You know, what did the Buddha mean? There's these layers, you know. And the number one meaning for this word, sati, is remembering, to remember. So it's like a process, it's a verb, not really a state. And the word mindful gets used both ways, mindfulness. It's used in English as a verb and as a noun, right? So we say, you know, people could say, you should be mindful, or he wasn't very mindful, or so that's an adjective too, you know. So it's used in different ways. But in the traditional sense, the question is mindful of what? Mindful of what? Or so remembering what? What are you remembering? What are you mindful of? Remembering is great, but you know what? What are you remembering? And so this first list of four foundations provides four areas of remembering. And we could take each one of these up and study them for quite a while, years probably. So foundation, kind of in the sense of like something to stand on, like a foundation of a house. And so taking up one of these foundations of mindfulness is a kind of process of choosing a sort of area of our experience to be the foundation of our life while we're studying it. So we kind of take up each of these foundations as kind of an area of study of experience, study of this process of remembering. And I'll get to how in a minute. And Tathasara Bhikkhu has an interesting translation, a pretty free translation. The words do mean something like foundation of mindfulness, but he translated it instead as frame of reference. So each of these is a frame of reference or a foundation. And one way I've been thinking about mindfulness, so we'll get back to the four foundations, but let's think about a little more about mindfulness as a process. And what does that mean, actually? So we have this consciousness and this thinking, and we're sort of aware of stuff, but what's actually happening, you know? So here's one possible way to think about that. I've been using the analogy lately of a searchlight or a spotlight in the theater. So you've been in the theater, right? So they have a spotlight. They can move around and shine on the stage. So we'll say it's a dark scene, right? And most of the stage can't be seen. And the spotlight is shining on one actor. So all you can really see or be aware of is that one actor. So the spotlight is like casting light. So the light is enabling awareness. So awareness is one thing. You can be aware of something. There's awareness. But then the spotlight can move around, right? Deliberately, maybe. Maybe not so deliberately, right? Things grab our attention. So that's attention. So attention is this kind of moving spotlight. The spotlight is creating light, you know, it creates awareness. So there's attention and awareness. And then mindfulness is this. You're sitting in this dark theater, engrossed in the show of your life. The spotlight's moving around. Different things are popping into your consciousness, and you're like, whoa, you know, seems a little bit out of control, right? And then you remember that you're actually sitting on a stool right in front of the spotlight, with your hands on the handles of the thing. And you forgot that you can actually move the spotlight. So mindfulness is the remembering that you can actually direct attention and have some influence over what you're aware of. Do you like that metaphor? That's really helping me to think about this way. You know, we don't have complete control of our spotlight, right? You know, things happen from the outside, external events that grab our attention, shift the spotlight over there. It just happened. And then there are internal events that grab the spotlight and move it around, right? A terrible memory or a worry about the future. This moves the spotlight, right? Sometimes turning the spotlight right into our self in a certain way. So that's awareness, attention, and mindfulness. And then one last word to kind of have some vocabulary to think about consciousness. The last word would be concentration. Concentration. So concentration is holding that spotlight steadily so that we're holding attention on one something, you know. And so there's some consistency to awareness and some stability. And usually we're able to calm down a little bit, you know. And, perfect timing. And one last aspect of this metaphor that's helpful is, you can not only can you direct your spotlight around the stage of your life and look at different things, have different things in awareness, but you can focus the beam, right? So it can be really narrow. So you're just looking at one little teeny aspect of experience, right? Or you can open it up wide, like whoop, and so the light's shining on the whole stage, less bright probably, right? Because it's spread out more. But you can in some way see the whole of your life. So mindfulness practice is kind of working with this. Remembering that it's possible, for one thing, because if you forget that you're actually holding the spotlight, you can't move it, right? You can't move it. And like I say, it's not like some kind of hardcore attentional control training, like a, just, you know, do enough mindfulness training here and you will never, you know, ever be distracted again. No. But we have a lot more sort of influence and freedom in this than maybe we think we do, just by virtue of the remembering. Just by virtue of the remembering. So that's a few metaphors about awareness, attention, mindfulness, and concentration. So four key concepts. And so this list of four foundations of mindfulness that head off the Bodhipakshika Dharma suggest four places we might want to shine our spotlight and see if we can hold the spotlight there steadily and investigate that aspect of our life. And it starts with the body. So that's why I said a few words during Zazen at the beginning about the body. And you know, Zen is more or less explicit that the body's involved, like we pay attention to posture. Some other schools of Buddhism didn't really pay too much attention to posture. But still, we come in here with our mind, right? The thinking is motoring along, you know, like as it always is, and we're thinking about how are we doing? Are we doing a good job in our zazen tonight? Oh, not too good. And we lose track of the actual experience of being embodied, right? So the Buddha suggests start with the body, return to the body. So in a way, this is really straightforward, like actually notice sensations in the body, the felt experience of the body. In the Mindfulness Sutra, you know, it has some funny phrases. Like it says that we should be mindful of the body in the body. The body in the body. So not like some outside agent looking at the body, like we're kind of out here somewhere. Oh, look at that, a body, wow. You know. But the body in the body. And Thanissaro translates that as the body in and of itself. In and of itself. So sensations in the body, feelings in the body. And breath is included here. Breath is included here. So breathing is a process of the body, which we treasure in Zen as they do in all schools of Buddhism. Because the breath is such a great support, isn't it? You know, it's always there, ready to remind you of what's happening now. But the other thing that's included in a mindfulness of the body, which is interesting, you wouldn't think this, is looking also at attitudes that spring from the body. Like, pause for a minute and consider this question. Do you like your body? A little bit? Maybe a few improvements are needed? Is your body the exact right weight, for instance? Height? You know, curves are all just the right way? Is your hair okay? That's why we saves us one thing. There's enough left. So what's interesting about traditional Buddhism is the way they expressed it, this investigation of attitude about the body, was they talked a lot about the impurity of the body. So they must have had some theory in medieval India about the body as sort of a pure thing that the Buddha was working with. Because it goes on and on about the impurity of the body, and I don't think we need that wording exactly. It's pretty for easy for us to be convinced that our body is just a mess, right? Impure. I think for us, it's to be really aware of our attitude and understanding of the body, and can we align that attitude and understanding with reality and with appreciation. Reality and appreciation. Because this is the only body we get, right? So we need to take care of it. It's our only body. Our only way of being alive. Our only vehicle of practice and love and joy. And there are a variety of practices we can do to study the body, you know, throughout our culture. And that in a way, it's so interesting, you know, we do have a kind of a cult of the body in a way. We have all these gyms and yoga classes and all martial arts and things. And yet there's also a certain way that even through all these disciplines and good, healthy things we try to do, long hikes, there's a way that we hold the body at arm's length too. Like, I am taking my body to the gym, you know, to take care of it. So who am I? You know? Where is the body? And so this practice of the foundation of mindfulness of the body is a kind of more of a deep entering into the body from the inside of the body. How do we hold the body? How do we feel about the body? How do we care for the body? One way to look at it, and there are many different ways to study this, one possible way is to look at it from the point of view of the three poisons. Right? Sometimes they say greed, hatred, and ignorance. You could say desire, anger, and confusion if you want. So notice, how does desire arise in relationship to the body? Is there a wanting the body to be different? Is there the wanting the body to change? Or is there a wanting the body to not change? Like, I thought I would get to show off my reading glasses tonight, but I forgot them. Fortunately, the lectern's far enough away. You know, all of a sudden I need reading glasses, you know, and I didn't sign up for that. So there's desire, right? There's greed that manifests in our attitudes in the body. And we can work with that. We can recognize that. We can turn to that. Practice with it. Mindfulness, right? Bringing awareness back. Ah, there's greed in my study of mindfulness of the body. We can be angry at the body, right? When it lets us down, when it gets sick, when it fails, when it's not quite doing what we want it to do. And we can be confused about the nature of the body, right? So there's all three poisons right there, and you can use lots of different frames to study the body. So I had planned to talk about the other four foundations, but maybe that's enough. I'm really trying to learn how to give shorter talks. I'm not very good at it. So let's consider this first foundation of mindfulness these next weeks. And having this little bit of framing that this is the beginning of a bigger process. And what else is neat as we study these other lists as well, is they work together in interesting ways. Which is part of why I was really happy about this list of lists being a traditional thing, is I studied all of these, you know, most of these I've studied separately. But then they kind of tend to pop up sort of independently, and you study them and you kind of put them down and forget about them. And what's been really interesting thinking about them together is the ways that they support each other. Like the second set of four, maybe I'll just say a few words about the second set of four, because they work beautifully with the first four, the four proper exertions. And this is another experiential moment-by-moment thing that we can talk a lot more about later. Guarding against unwholesome states, and you can add not yet, or I shorten these a little bit for chanting. So the full thing is guarding against unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. So what can we do to reduce the arising of things that are difficult, unwholesome, unhealthy, causing suffering? What can we do to guard against the arising of those unwholesome states? But then the Buddha was so realistic, you know. He's like, okay, but then they come anyway. Then what do you do? So the second point he makes is abandoning unwholesome states once they have arisen. So you guard against them, they come, some come anyway, so then you work on releasing from those. And then he says, cultivating wholesome states not yet arisen. So how do we set up our life and our schedule and our, you know, work and our eating and our everything to make it more possible for wholesome states to arise, whatever those may be, and we'll investigate that later. Things that feel deeply right, maybe, is one way to say it. Things that increase awareness, increase lasting joy and contentment. And then he says, maintaining wholesome states once they have arisen. So how do we, you know, keep those things? And what's interesting about this teaching is it seems, on the face of it, to sort of fly in the face of just accept everything, right? This is a fairly manipulative instruction, right? Set up your life to reduce this and increase that. So there is actually discernment and manipulation in Buddhist practice. It's just a question of how we do it, you know? What's truly skillful in how we work with the mind. And one thing that I've been really using, so we can use all this frame to study the body, right? You know? How do we guard against unwholesome states arising in the body, and so on? And we can use this second set of four with all kinds of stuff, too. I've been actually really interested in this in regard to self-talk. What are the ways that we talk to ourselves about what's happening that cultivate wholesome or unwholesome states? Yeah, I see some heads nodding. You know this? You know? And, you know, we're actually have some influence over our thinking, or at least how we regard and feed our thinking. So these teachings are really helpful. So maybe that's enough for tonight. And this is what we'll study at the study retreat, which is, I think, like 2 weekends from this coming one or something like that, or a week from this coming one?
Two.
Two? Okay, good. So I hope if you have that weekend free, you can come study some more. And we'll do, not just me talking, we'll do experiential, interactive stuff, so it won't just be talk. And then during that weekend, the Saturday morning talk of the retreat will also be a public talk, so you can come to that. So good, I left myself a few minutes so I can talk about this last weekend, which is wonderful. Okay, especially nice because Bob is here. So our community empowered 6 people in the end, it turned out to be 6 people. To do a 100-mile silent hike around Mount Rainier. As far as we know, it's never been done before. Maybe it has, yeah, but we can still feel good about that. And a kind of a ritual engagement with, you know, our biggest mountain as sacred space. And so I went down on Friday night with Leslie Dalaba from Seattle to greet the hikers returning and cook for them and Dave provided us with enormous amounts of wonderful food from his garden to feed them with, and it was really great. And we got really lucky actually. Leslie and I went on a little walk the morning we got there Friday night, and they were supposed to show up sort of mid morning on Saturday. And Leslie and I went on a walk. We thought maybe the direction they'd be coming from, and we weren't really sure. But we met them on the trail, so that was nice. They had their backs on, and you know, they were like in the last mile and a half of a 100-mile hike, and it was just a sweet moment, and very quiet, you know. Leslie gave them fresh plums. And then we went back to the camp and the lettuce. It's great. But it was so beautiful, and they were so, you know, they had really purified body and mind somehow doing this practice. They were really glowing and very content, and, you know, sore knees and, you know, not that kind of stuff, of course. But so I just wanted to mention that went really well, And we're trying to sort of, Bob and I, thinking about how could he get to do more of that work, and how will that kind of fit into Sangha life, who knows. But somehow this vision came true. So I just wanted to mention that since you didn't get to be there. And we'll do other kind of wilderness things too, I think, that are more accessible and closer to home as well. And actually, I don't know what the Eno has planned, but I can't be here next week. So if you're around, Bob, I wonder if you could say a few words next week about what that whole experience was and what you guys did, and okay. Tell the story, you know? Tell the story, because I wasn't there. Yeah, maybe show some videos, slideshow maybe. Wow. So maybe next week we'll have a little, some kind of telling of the story. Anyway, any questions or comments about the Bodhipakshika Dharma? Is that okay? Is it a little bit overwhelming or interesting? Or I just want to sit. Why do we have to deal with this stuff? You know?
just one comment that to do the second set, the 4 proper exertions, it's really helpful to do the first step, because becoming aware of your
exactly.
body, because the wholesome and unwholesome things
if you don't,
do have a place in your body.
If you don't feel that, yeah, yeah. And the way Sheng Yen introduces it, you actually do preparatory practices even before the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is essentially our Zazen practice, you know, just breath awareness and stabilizing the mind, stabilizing the body.
But, and then, of course, as soon as you identify some unwholesome things, you can then go back to the body and feel where that is, the sensations.
Right, right. Absolutely,
so
yeah.
It's very integrated.
Yeah, and it's not a sort of a mental, just a mental thing. Yeah, thank you for that. Yes, Mina.
Two things. One, the first thing I thought of when you were describing the word remembering, for some reason I turned it around into not forgetting. And for some reason, thinking of not forgetting the body registered.
Yeah, not forgetting the body. Yeah,
and
there it is.
In a way that I understood it better.
Yeah.
And then also I was listening to this popular Canadian radio station today, and that there was this meditation guide or the this lady who has helped lots of celebrities, and her whole thing is breathing, and she said something interesting that we're always meditating, even when we're angry or stressed out or worried or whatever. And this, her easy trick is to just breathe and get out of that shallow breathing pattern, and then just to breathe and think about something else and to turn.
Yeah, so it's moving the attention. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
I just want to add that the book, The Wings to Awakening, and Tim has the book online, right? But it's free from the Metaphorist Monastery. So if you go online, you can.
Yeah, they'll send it to you in print too. It'll be easier to read than
on
the computer, yeah. Yeah, no, that's part of their whole trip is, yeah, they don't sell, you know, the Dharma is to be given away, so they give away all their books, yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, that's enough for tonight, huh? I say we'll just try to work our way through this, maybe it'll take a while, who knows how long.
A lifetime.
A lifetime, yeah, certainly some years. Maybe we'll take little breaks for nice Zen stories and poetry and stuff too, you know, it's not just like something to do. Well, somehow, the super genius of Zen, right, is somehow all of this is just included in one, like one koan story or one image or one moment, you know, one breath. And yet it can help, you know, to unpack all that from time to time.